It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. The United States is one of the richest nations on Earth, and yet our guest says it's difficult for millions of Americans to make ends meet.
A new book argues that a strengthened American welfare system is a viable solution to many of the U.S.'s financial and social problems.
And with us today is the author of that book, Lane Kenworthy. He is a professor of sociology and political science at the University of Arizona, and the author of the book we'll be discussing, Social Democratic America. Lane, welcome to Central Time.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
I want to start out with the very first sentence in the book that says something along the lines of, America is a very rich nation. And then it goes on to describe the ways in which we are rich. And, you know, it's an interesting sentence to begin with, because as we all listen to budget news, as we all read the headlines, as we all, you know, see what's happening, sometimes it doesn't feel that way. But it is.
Yeah, it's true. We're, you know, by historical and comparative standards, we're an incredibly rich nation. Hopefully we'll get a good bit richer, and I'm sure everyone wishes we already were. But a lot of the stalemate that you're referring to has to do with politics. And a really important feature of the approach I take in this book is to think about the medium and long run instead of getting too bogged down in what's going on right now. I should say that part of the argument that I advance in the book is that we're likely to become a lot more generous and expansive in our government social programs over the next half century, but I don't actually think that a whole lot is going to happen in the next couple of years.
Yeah, in fact, and we'll be getting into some of those details about what you would like to have see happening. You talk about the problems and so forth. But early on in the book, you talk about some of the things that we need: universal health care, 1 year paid paternal leave, sickness insurance, wage insurance, and so forth. And you say, I've arrived at this list not by consulting the latest edition of the Progressive's Handbook, but by examining the problems we face and the experiences of the world's rich nations in addressing them. And you make a point of saying here that this is not just a predictable laundry list of the left. In fact, at one point you say that anybody who believes that you are with the left on some of these issues is mistaken. And I'm wondering if before we get into the meat and potatoes of this, you could talk about that, because a lot of people are going to see this title, they're going to hear what we're talking about, and they are immediately going to assume a worldview.
Yeah, so I'm a social scientist, and I try as best I can. I do have my own ideological predilections and my own partisan views, but I try as best I can to try to figure out what evidence tells us from, and in this case, my focus is on the experience of the world's rich countries, so about 20 or so nations. And it's quite striking that if you step back and take a little bit bigger picture view, that every single one of these nations has expanded the scope and generosity of an array of government programs over the last century. They've done it to varying degrees. We're close to the bottom of the list in terms of our generosity, but they've all done this, and I think it's for a very good reason. Really two reasons. One is that public insurance programs do a very good job in mitigating risks. And in a rich country, a lot of people want to mitigate risk. You can see that during people's life course, for example. The more money they get, the more insurance they tend to buy on their own. And you can see it both across countries and over time within countries. And then the other element there is fairness. So there's lots and lots of disagreement in the United States about exactly what we should do and what type of outcomes or goals we should privilege. And yet, for almost everyone, there's a core belief that as we get richer, we can afford to be fairer. We can afford the manifestation of this is we can afford to spend more money helping those who are less fortunate in a whole variety of ways. And so the fact that you see this in the experience of every single one of these countries, I think tells you something very interesting about what society's like and about where we're likely to continue to go.
Let's start out. You devote a chapter to, in fact, it's called What's the Problem? And let's talk about the problems as you see them. As I read the chapter, it appears to me that one of the main issues is that of income, that lots of low incomes out there, and your prediction is that it's not necessarily going to get any better.
Yeah, I think that's right. So I start out by talking about economic insecurity, just the inability to meet your expenses. And having low income is a really important part of this. The other components there are having an unstable income and having a large unanticipated expense. But low income, and we usually use the term poverty, or the debate sort of couched around poverty when we're speaking of low income, remains surprisingly pervasive. There's been a fair amount of attention devoted to this in the last few months with the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty, or the Declaration of the War on Poverty. But it's really striking that the average income, for example, of households in the bottom fifth of incomes in the United States is only about $18,000 a year. So that's one in five American households that have an average income, and of course quite a few in that group have less than that. That's a really tough income to make ends meet on. I refer to this as scraping by. And given the wealth of the country, we could be doing better. We know that because we've done steadily better over the last century or so. And again, other countries that have some of the types of programs or more generous versions of some of the programs that I focus on do better in ensuring that those with low incomes, and there are some people with low incomes in all of these countries, but there are fewer of them, and their incomes tend to be a bit higher in countries that do better on these programs.
So one of the things we should have done earlier in the interview is define exactly what social democracy is, and then maybe talk a little bit about how America already has adopted some of these things.
Right. So it's one of these terms that everybody has their own definition for, but I use it more or less in its traditional way, which is to associate it with the goals and aims of social democratic movements and specifically political parties, which have existed mainly in Western Europe. The Democratic Party's never been quite along these lines, although there have always been some elements of it within the Democratic Party. But the idea is simply to use government programs to try to achieve these goals, economic security, broader opportunity, and shared prosperity. Doesn't mean you only use government, of course. I mean, we rely on firms, we rely on families, we rely on voluntary organizations. But it does mean that you rely to a considerable extent on public programs.
And a lot of the examples that you point to are ones that we are familiar with in the Nordic countries, for example.
That's right. Denmark and Sweden are often considered the kind of paramount examples here. Norway, too, although Norway I try not to infer too much from because it's got so much oil revenue that it's really a kind of exceptional country these days. But, yeah, going back to your previous question, it is the case that here in the United States, almost nobody would refer to the United States as a social democracy currently. But think about the distance between the United States now and the United States a century ago. So back in 1915 or 1920, government spending totaled only about 12% of our GDP. That's spending at all levels, federal, state, local. Just before the recession hit, which is kind of the best time to measure because of the recession throws these numbers out of whack a bit, government spending was about 37% of GDP. Still a good bit below that of many other rich nations around the world, but that's light years apart from where we were before. And much of that has to do with programs like Social Security and Medicare and a whole array of other things that already exist, many of which are quite good and we could simply build on. So if we were to become a social democratic America, we wouldn't have to start from scratch.
And when you talk about addressing some of these issues, and you just mentioned Social Security and Medicare and so on, you do say in your book that it's not probably going to happen all at once, that fits and starts are kind of going to be what we're looking at.
Right. Well, that's certainly been the historical pattern. And I should say we don't – so social scientists have put a lot of effort, especially political scientists and sociologists, into trying to understand when and why we do get these advances in the scope and generosity of government social programs. And we really don't have a very good systematic explanation for when and why that's happened. Sometimes the economy's been really bad, like in the Depression. Sometimes it's been really good, like in the 1960s. Much of the time, Democrats have been influential, but not always. Republicans were in charge when the earned income tax credit, for example, was put in, and Medicaid was expanded in the 1980s. Sometimes unions have been really influential in pushing for it, other times social movements, and sometimes they haven't played much of a role at all, and it's been much more of a technocratic process. But what we do know is that little by little, sometimes at very unexpected moments, we have put into place new programs. And usually because they tend to work quite well, that's not always the case, but often is the case, they become popular, and so it's difficult and therefore unlikely for them to disappear. And so we sort of slowly but steadily built part of what I would call a social democratic America.
We're talking with Lane Kenworthy, a professor of sociology and political science at the University of Arizona, about his book, Social Democratic America. We'd like to hear from you. So what are your thoughts on adopting a social democratic system of government in America? And would a wider social safety net help or harm the U.S. in the long run? Are you for it or against us? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or drop us an email, talk@WPR.org. We're talking with Lane Kenworthy, professor of sociology and political science at the University of Arizona, about his new book, Social Democratic America, where he outlines how a social democratic system of government could help solve America's social and financial problems. And we're taking your calls now. What do you think about this idea? More government involvement, more government spending, is that the way the future looks to you? Would a social democracy make for a better, stronger America? Why or why not? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That is 800-642-1234. Let's head to the phones right away. We've got some listeners who would like to join in, and we begin with John, who joins us from Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hello. I would. I don't know if you ever heard of Webster Tarpley, but he's got some good ideas, I think, including the one of like confiscating the private bank, the Federal Reserve Bank, and have that lend money when it's nationalized to the government at 0% interest. And the second is, how can we afford social democracy if we're spending enormous amounts of money for war and militarization of our police state in America, the national security state?
John, thanks so much for the call. And Lane Kenworthy, what about that? That is going to be an argument, and you've got a chapter on objections in here, and that has to be one that you hear often.
Yeah, so it's actually the one that I start with in that chapter on objections and alternatives. It's a key question. So roughly speaking, I suggest that about half a century from now, we're likely to spend about 10% more of our GDP on various types of programs, some of the ones that already exist and various new ones, for example, universal early education. And so how are we going to get those revenues? Well, it's as a technical matter, it's actually not very difficult to do that. The politics will be harder, although as I've suggested, I'm pretty optimistic in the long run that we'll get the agreement, as we have for the most part over the last century or so. But let me just give you a sense of some of the ways that we could do this. The starting point, I think, is a national consumption tax, probably designed along the lines of a value-added tax. This is very common in Western Europe. In fact, we're the only rich country in the world that doesn't have something like this. We do have it's a type of consumption tax. We do have a lot of this at the state and local level, but it raises a fairly small amount of money, and we could pretty easily add another 5% of GDP or get another 5% of GDP through a national value-added tax or some other form of consumption tax. And then there are lots of little things that we could do. Like, for example, returning to the pre-George W. Bush federal income tax rates for everybody. We've already done that for those at the top with the tax agreement last year, but we could do it for everyone. That would get us another 2% or so of GDP. A carbon tax, a financial transactions tax, increasing the cap on the amount of earnings that are subject to the Social Security payroll tax. That's been dropping pretty steadily for the last several decades. We could increase the payroll tax just a little bit, and then in addition, add a few new higher, not dramatically higher, but somewhat higher tax rates on for the richest Americans who get an awful lot more money nowadays than they did a generation or even a decade or so ago, and therefore can afford to pay a little bit more. I'm not proposing anything like an 80 or 90% tax rate for those people, but another 4 or 5% higher effective tax rate. All of those things combined would get you to 10% of GDP, which seems unimaginable when you just think of the number 10%, but I do think that we can generate that.
Let's go to James right now. James is with us from Fort Atkinson. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess you might have sort of addressed this. I guess I'm wondering in your work whether you've kind of taken into consideration how much pushback there would be against something like this, and how people who see the government taxing more, even for something that they might support, social programs and such, as being a drag on their personal incomes and their ability to move ahead in America, those types of issues.
James, thanks so much for the call. And Lane Kenworthy, that is a big question. You've got the Tea Party out there. You've got a real feeling of a frugality within certain parts of the government, whether you're talking federal or state. How do you push back against that?
Well, the Tea Party really is a very formidable obstacle. And if it were to persist in its current form or even get stronger, over the long run, I really do think that that might change the landscape of American politics. But history suggests that it won't. There's been no real active radical wing of either major party that's been able to sustain itself over the long run without in keeping its core approach or its core beliefs that it starts out with. Normally what happens is either it breaks off and forms a third party, and third parties have a very difficult time lasting in our electoral system, or it gets absorbed and integrated into the mainstream of the party that it joins. So my best guess, again, based on history, not just on wishful thinking, is that the Tea Party, in its current form, with its current views and demands, simply won't persist. That doesn't mean it won't be around 5 or 10 years from now. It just means that 30 or 40 years from now, it's very, very unlikely to exist. I think, as I suggested earlier, that right at this moment, there is very, very limited likelihood of any kind of progress on the types of policies that I'm talking about. But we go through phases or cycles in American politics. And I don't think anybody in 2006 would have, or let's say 2004, when George Bush had just been reelected, would have imagined that 5 years later we would have gotten major health care reform in the country.
And we've only got about 30 seconds or so left, but you take the long view and you say, we're going to get there.
Yeah, that's right. I'm very optimistic about policy. I'll restate what you mentioned earlier. I'm not at all optimistic about economic trends in the economy and in society. I suspect that there's going to be more family instability, that wages in the lower half are not likely to rise. We're going to have a very difficult time increasing employment going forward, and that's indeed part of the reason why we're likely to, in the end, again, in fits and starts, move toward more use of public programs.
That was Lane Kenworthy, professor of sociology and political science at the University of Arizona. He's the author of the book we've been talking about, Social Democratic America, and blogs at Consider the Evidence.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, an Iraq war widow shares her personal story of losing her husband in the war.
Before that, we're talking about some of the legislation being considered today in the State Assembly and in the Senate. There are some constitutional amendments up for a vote in the Assembly, and the Senate is voting on several bills, including one that would limit the power of circuit court judges.
Sean Johnson joins us from the state capitol now, where he has been covering the state legislature all day. He is the state government reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Sean, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it is always good to find out what is happening in the Capitol. One of the big stories that we've been hearing a lot about ever since Governor Walker proposed it some time ago were these tax cuts. The state had that extra money lying about. Governor Walker proposed a series of tax cuts. What's been happening in the Assembly?
Yeah, well, they're going to pass a plan today that closely resembles what Governor Walker first introduced in his State of the State address. It's, you can call this the Walker proposal almost. And it's largely a symbolic vote, though, because they still know that the Senate needs to make some changes to it. They haven't even referred it to the legislature's budget committee yet, the Joint Finance Committee. And so what you have here is Assembly Republicans. They want to take this clean, symbolic vote, put some pressure on the Senate, which is, you know, a little bit rare in the legislature. You don't often see this kind of infighting publicly between Republicans. And so, you know, from that sort of inside baseball perspective, it's interesting. But, you know, what they pass today is not going to be the final product.
As you said, the plan passed today closely resembles Governor Walker's plan. What were the changes?
If there's, you know, there's one change really that they added in the assembly, and that's a tax credit for construction. They've already talked about paring that back a bit. And, you know, otherwise the governor's plan is basically intact. It would be a $400 million property tax credit. That's sort of the centerpiece of the plan as far as Republicans are concerned. About a $100 million income tax credit that's targeted at the lowest bracket. $117 million deposit in the state's rainy day fund. Now, that's probably going to go away in the Senate version. And then, you know, overall, it would leave the state with a larger structural deficit. And again, that's a change that's probably going to go away in the Senate version.
But we'll have to wait and see how that turns out.
Yeah, and I mean, that's sort of the cobbling together the votes in the Senate is going to be tougher just because they have a smaller margin over there.
Now, the State Assembly, as I understand it, also taking up a constitutional amendment that would change how taxes are raised in Wisconsin. What taxes are we talking about?
Yeah, that, I mean, if you're talking about an income tax or a sales tax increase, this would require a supermajority vote or a two-thirds vote. Could be a potentially big deal because, you know, usually when those taxes are raised, it's when stuff happens in a hurry. You know, when the economy goes into a recession, I think about Jim Doyle's last budget. He'd spent his first term talking about how the state taxes too much and sort of tried to develop this brand as a moderate Democrat, somebody who was against tax increases. And then here he found himself in a situation where, you know, the bottom was falling out and his budget included a number of tax increases. He wouldn't have been able to do that so easily under this plan because you would have required a two-thirds majority vote and they wouldn't have had it at the time. And so it's significant. But again, this is one of those where it might be a symbolic vote. You don't know where the Senate's at on this. It's a pretty, you know, pretty broad move. And, you know, the Senate might not be on board.
And forgive me for not knowing the answer to this, but has Governor Walker weighed in on that?
I have not heard the governor weigh in on that specific proposal. It'd be out of his hands because it's a constitutional amendment. It'd have to pass the legislature twice and then go before voters. It's interesting in that it would actually potentially tie his hands if he wants to do some big changes to the income and sales tax. You know, so for example, he sort of floated the idea of, in order to eliminate the income tax, potentially having an increase in the sales tax to offset that, his hands would be tied there. He couldn't do that without a two-thirds majority vote in the legislature. And so it would have consequences for, you know, governors of either party.
And speaking of constitutional amendments, there was another issue in the State Assembly today, a proposal to eliminate the position of state treasurer. And there is a position that has been talked about for some time.
Yeah, the treasurer and the secretary of state, actually this plan was going to eliminate both of them, but it was amended down to just focus on the treasurer. And that's an office that just in this last state budget had its duties significantly pared down. The current officer, Kurt Schuller, actually campaigned on eliminating the office. He's not running again, so it's not exactly a tense situation there for Republicans. But again, this is one where I don't know what's going to happen in the state Senate. They said they haven't really met privately on this to discuss it. And, you know, they haven't caucused on it is the term that gets used. And so it might be another one of those symbolic votes we see today.
Now, over on the Senate side, a couple of things to talk about there as well. In fact, a vote today on establishing a Fox Cities Regional Transit Authority. First of all, what is the significance of that, and then how did that vote go?
Yeah, and this is one that I can tell you is definitely not going anywhere, but it would be very significant for the Fox Cities region. It would let them band together, if they voted by referendum to create this Fox Cities Regional Transit Authority, give them the power to levy a sales tax to support a bus system. That's a region that's going to potentially lose federal funding for its bus system because its population is growing. And so it's, you know, hugely significant for the region. And as a nod to that, you have the sponsors of the bill are Republican Senate President Mike Ellis and Democratic Assemblywoman Penny Bernard Schaber. Just a sign of, you know, how political this is. Those two are running against each other this November, and is no doubt part of the reason why Mike Ellis wanted to have a vote on this in the Senate. He got it. He got a bipartisan 25-7 vote in support of the bill, but Speaker Robin Voss says it's just not going anywhere in the Assembly.
And another bill in the Senate that, in the wake of Act 10 and some of the legislation that came out of that, there is a bill that would curb the power, as I understand it, of circuit court judges, a bill that's already received a significant amount of discussion. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and this version is way pared back compared to what you heard talked about last session when it was first introduced. That original version would have significantly limited the power of circuit court judges to block a state law. So when you think back to Act 10, it's been enjoined or blocked at the circuit court level a couple times, different facets of it, based on a county judge ruling. The bill that was introduced originally would have, you know, all but taken away the power of county judges to do that in lawsuits against the state. Clearly, they didn't have the votes for that in the state Senate because they pared it back dramatically. And the version that they passed today would actually just say that, you know, when there's a judgment against the state, you know, you have a right to an immediate appeal. I'm not sure exactly what the tangible effect of that would be, because we've seen some pretty quick appeals in some of these cases, and the Supreme Court can always grant an expedited appeal. So that's one where you saw this potential dramatic step that the Assembly was wanting to take. The Senate wasn't on board.
And so finally, to wrap up here, what bills should we be keeping our eyes on, bills that are actually going to advance, make it out of the legislature, and then wind up in Governor Walker's desk?
Well, I mean, that tax cut plan is going to, something's going to happen there. Republicans aren't going to go home without doing something with projected surplus. They could. I mean, they could leave it alone and say, we've got this to use in the next budget. But that's really going to be the story of the remainder of the session, is what they do there. They're also debating what to do with some type of a school report card bill and a school accountability bill, whether you want to actually punish schools that perform badly by removing public funding. But that's one where, again, the two houses are not on the same page.
And this has to be wrapped up when?
And that's also a matter of contention, believe it or not. I mean, they're scheduled to be done, or they're scheduled to be in session through the first week of April. Speaker Robin Voss says he wants to be in maybe a couple days in early March and then be done. So that's a pretty unusual move. And, you know, it could be that Voss is trying to kind of dictate terms in negotiations with the Senate on all these outstanding issues.
Boy, lots of things to keep our eyes on. Sean, thanks so much for joining us today.
All right. Thanks, Gene.
That was Sean Johnson, state government reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, joining us today to talk about some of the legislation that lawmakers were voting on today at the state capitol. The United States has been at war since October of 2001, and as of the end of last year, over 4,600 soldiers have died in Iraq and Afghanistan.
One aspect that can get overlooked during wartime is who's left behind when a soldier dies. In military parlance, women who lose their husbands are called unremarried widows. Artis Henderson's husband died in a helicopter crash in the Iraq War in 2006, only 6 months after their marriage. Artis is a journalist and a writer, which allows her to articulate her loss and share it with the world, which she does in her new memoir, Unremarried Widow. Artis, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Before he was deployed, your husband had a dream that scared you. He dreamed of his own death. And that must be something that's always playing in the background in the minds of military families. How much weight did the two of you put on that dream when your husband had it?
I think when he first had the dream, we were both frightened. It felt like a premonition. But I think that military families are very good at sort of separating our worries about the future and daily life. Otherwise, it's too weighty.
And what did he dream?
He dreamt that he died in a helicopter crash, which he did, and he dreamt that he was with the co-pilot that he actually died with.
So he had a what turned out to be a direct premonition of his death that morning.
Yes, that's right.
And your husband deployed only 3 months after your marriage, and the two of you were, from the looks of it and from your book, incredibly in love. I saw a picture of the two of you taken the day before he deployed, and it's a beautiful picture. Is that how you felt on that day, that you were incredibly in love and having to let go of someone that you couldn't bear to get to let go of at that time?
Yes, that's absolutely right. I couldn't, you know, when he went away to training, we said we couldn't imagine being apart for 3 weeks. And then when he deployed, we couldn't imagine being apart for a year. And now.
Did you ever think, you know, maybe this isn't the right thing for us? It's so hard for us to be apart. Did you ever weigh the balance of being in the military?
I don't know. You know, we hadn't gotten to that point. When I met him, he was already in the military, and he still had about 5 years left on his commitment. So we did. We talked about the future a lot, but we had a long haul until he was done.
Yeah. Well, you'd always had a vision of your life as a writer living abroad. You thought about being freewheeling, and you had lived in Paris for a while already. But you chose to marry a military man to be part of this circle of military wives. How did you, in that beginning time, how did you make peace with these dreams you'd had of what your life would be and what your life actually was when you were married?
That was something I struggled with almost every day. And I'm not sure that my time with Miles, I ever made peace with it. It was something I was trying to sort out, how to live my own life and still be part of this military community. It's very difficult. There are a lot of sacrifices for military spouses.
What kind of sacrifices?
Well, we're very much tied to our partners, and the military decides which, you know, for the most part, which base you'll go to and how long you'll spend there. And as a spouse, your choice is to follow or to stay in one place. And those are kind of the two choices.
And how did you fit in with the community of military wives on these bases where you lived?
I think initially I had a hard time fitting in. I was younger. At first, we weren't married, and so when you're not married in the military, you have no status, of course. So I was somewhat on the outside. I didn't have children, and then also I had these plans of traveling and kind of living my own life, and that maybe didn't fit in so well with that community.
Did you reach a point where you felt like you understood why they were close-knit and you were part of them? Did you get to that point?
Yes. I 100% see that. It's unfortunate that it took losing Miles to see that, because once he was gone, once I lost him and he died, the military community really rallied around me. And I'm so very close to both military widows and the military wives from his unit.
What do you remember about the day that you learned your husband wasn't coming back from Iraq? Did it feel different than other days?
In hindsight, I can see, yes, it was so different. At the time, something felt wrong, but I didn't know enough to say what it was. And then later, I can see how the whole day felt dark.
We see that moment in movies, on TV, quite a lot, when the wife or the partner gets the news that her spouse, her partner, has fallen in war, that they're not coming back. But what does that moment actually feel like when it happens?
It feels like nothing you imagine. You know, I think as a military spouse, as a military wife, you imagine it, you think about it a lot, what it might look like if it happens. And when it happened, it looked nothing like I had foreseen. And it felt, I can't even describe how awful it felt.
The two soldiers who told you, they were in your home when you came in, right?
Yes, I was living with my mom when he deployed, so my mom had already come home from work, so she had let them in. So by the time I came home, they were in the house.
You use a phrase at one point that is apparently a military phrase. It's called right of the boom. It's what happens after a catastrophic event. It sounds like a loss of life. And it also sounds like it describes the protocols of what happens after a death. So what happened after that big moment, after that boom that hit you and your husband?
Yes. So right after, so the soldiers are there, the chaplain, and then the other one who's not a chaplain, and you can ask them to stay, but I didn't, and so they left, and then kind of this hole in my life opened up, and then there's certain procedures you have to go through. His things came home from Iraq. There was an official military briefing where I learned the cause of his death. I guess that's the sort of, I had to get a new military ID with my new status on it.
And you also learned that the pilot who died with your husband, Miles, was the same pilot that he dreamed about crashing with.
Yes. Yes. It's unbelievable.
How did becoming a widow yourself change your relationship with your mother? You were living with her. What happened with the two of you?
It's been incredible, my relationship with my mom, because my father died when I was 5, and my mom never remarried. And growing up, I never really understood why she handled my father's death the way she did. And then after Miles died, I found myself doing exactly the same thing she had done. And I think for the first time in my life, I understood why she had lived how she lived. And so I think we were close before, but I think we are even closer now.
When we read about the stages of grief, something you come across is that you don't get over a death or a loss like that, that you just sort of learn to carry it. How have you learned to carry it since Miles died?
It has been a long learning process. I've done the things that people do. I was in a grief group. I'm friends with other widows. And I think that writing this book in a lot of ways helped me learn to carry it.
Is there a message for other Army widows or widowers that you'd like to share as a writer and as someone who's been through this?
I think that grieving in general, and especially after a military death, is so lonely. I think that we find ourselves just so alone, and I just want them to know that someone else is hurting like they're hurting.
And have you heard from people who've said, "Artist, thank you for writing this. I don't feel as alone as I did."
I have. People have been so generous about this book.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about it today. I know it's painful, but it's a beautiful book. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Artis Henderson, a journalist and the author of Unremarried Widow. In the book, she tells the story of her husband's death in the Iraq War in 2006 and how she rebuilt her life afterwards.